Good afternoon. So last time we were talking, pthread create and join are our threading tools for starting threads and waiting for them to finish. Mentioned about sort of threads racing against each other, that you had these inconsistent results, where one thread might execute first sometimes, not others. We saw that with, you know, waiting for main to call xset sometimes before another thread, sometimes not. We saw that with our toy synchronization problem of trying to buy some milk only once. We also talked a bit about sort of more general threading things, about thinking about where data is stored, how do you pass it to threads. We saw some various ways of doing that, which might come in handy later on when you need to write threaded code. And we went through a lot of stuff about trying to implement mutual exclusion. We went to do one thing at a time, and we tried really hard to do it with atomic load and store. Eventually we had a solution, but it was really annoying. So we talked about really making locks. We looked at mutexes and acquire release in XV6. We saw these interfaces, so we're gonna talk about how you implement those. We started with our simplest single core implementation. So our simple single core implementation is that you disable interrupts when you lock, you enable them when you don't. And this is fine as long as you assume that no one's going to go into an infinite loop while they have your lock held, no one's going to try to like read from the disk while they have your lock held, and no one's going to try to have another lock while they have your lock held. But we can fix this last problem, and this is in fact how XV6's acquire and release works on a single core. This is how they achieve that there's no interruptions, that acquire calls this push CLI function, and release calls this pop CLI, and these functions keep a counter for each CPU of how many times have they been called, where push increments the counter, pop decrements it, and when that counter becomes zero, it disables it. So effectively, push CLI is disable interrupts if they're not already, and pop CLI is enable interrupts if the corresponding paired push CLI disable them. But not if they were already disabled for that one. So it handles nested locks, but it doesn't handle these cases of what if someone does an infinite loop, what if someone tries to do IO. But that's fine in the kernel, because in XV6 code, we know the kernel code that we need this for is not going to be code that does IO and goes into an infinite loop. So it's actually perfectly fine for synchronizing in the kernel. But it's not acceptable for a user program. You know, we don't want someone to accidentally hang the system. People are going to want to have mutual exclusion for things that like involve writing files, writing output. And we want to support that. And also, this only works on a single core. It does work very well on a single core because by disabling interrupts, we don't have to worry about a timer interrupt going in the middle of our lock and messing things up. But it's not going to be enough. So we're going to use a fancier mechanism. But first, I'm going to go through an interlude on why we can't even do the things we talked about. So for multicore, we said, well, if we have atomic load and store, we have a way of building a lock. So maybe at least that works. And it turns out that the way multicore processors work is way less intuitive than that. So even though like atomic loads and stores were sufficient, but like just really hard to think about what works, and you have to like do all this busy waiting, like it turns out that you can't actually do that because loads and stores aren't actually atomic in the way we want. And this is going to come up in our lock implementation where we're going to have to use special hardware support to get anything done on a multicore. That if you don't have hardware telling you this is useful for locks, it probably isn't. And as an example, here's some simple multi-threaded code. where I have two global variables, x and y. In thread A, this thread A function, I set x to 1 and I return y. In thread B, I set y to 1 and I return x. So these are two functions which write a global variable and read it in opposite pairs. And we're going to run them at the same time. So sometimes thread A is going to run first. So x is 0 initially. It's going to set it to 1 and return 0 for y. And then thread B would run, set y to 1, and return 1 for x. So that's one possibility. If it goes the other way, if thread B runs first, it sets y to 1, sets x, returns x as 0, and then thread A runs, it reads x as 1, sorry, it sets x to 1 and returns y as 1. And there's another possibility that's pretty clear, that could even happen on a single core, which is that we could run the first instruction of thread A, then we could context switch to thread B, and set y to 1, read x as 1, and then switch back to thread A, read x, y as 1 now, and return 1 and 1. So it seems like there are three possibilities with our usual notion of how loads and stores work, that if we assume when we load a value, it's atomic, and we store it, it's atomic. So let's see what actually happens when we run this. So I ran this on my desktop 100 million times, and these are the results I got. So almost all the time, A executed first, and that makes sense because I started A first. So my scheduler happened to run it first. Sometimes B executed first about 0.2% of the time. And about 0.004% of the time, we had that case where we ran the first move instruction of one of these and then context switched, basically. And about 0.0004% of the time, we have this case where I get 0 and 0, which seems impossible. And you might say, well, is this a bug? No, this is real documented behavior that is expected, that our processor manufacturer, if you read their manual, tells us, yeah, this happens. So what's going on? Why is this happening? And the fundamental underlying reason is because of how processors make themselves fast. So processors, to be fast, they don't execute this instruction, then the next instruction, then the next instruction. They try to execute lots of instructions at once, and they in fact try to execute them in whatever order is fastest. We might have talked about this in 30-30, telling you no. They execute instructions in these different orders. This is great for performance. We can hide delays from slow caches. And this is relevant here. So let's say, you know, reading X is going to be slow, we can start that read early and speed it up. Or writing Y is slow, we can just start writing Y, we can read X while we're doing that. And yeah, writing Y might take a while, but that's okay. You know, that's how the processor works. But it kind of messes up this case if we decide, oh, I can't write Y white array, I'm just going to take a while to do that. That kind of messes things up here. So processors do what is known as load and store reordering. That the loads and stores, yes, they execute all at once, but they don't actually execute in the order they appear in your program. And this is because they want to do things like, if the value's not immediately available, let's get it when it's available and do other work while we're waiting for it. Which is usually awesome for you. It makes your program run so much faster than it would otherwise. That's great. Now, you might say, well, do processors just do this arbitrarily? Can we, like, do they just load things whenever they want? So there are some restrictions. So there's two types of restrictions. So first, most processors have a set of rules as to when they will actually do reorder loads and stores that appear normally. So in x86, they have some helpful restrictions. So one is that each core sees its loads and stores in order. So if you store a value and then load that value in a single program, in a single thread, you'll at least read the value you just stored. So that's pretty obvious, but you know, that is actually there, so that happens. There's another more important restriction, which is that stores from other cores appear in a consistent order. So if you're reading values that were written elsewhere, and you see that x changes to 2, then 3, then 4, from some other core doing something, everyone's gonna see that in the same order. There's not gonna be two different orders in which X changed. And there's also this causality restriction that if someone reads a value and then uses that to compute another value, then someone computing that new value will not then be able to read an older version of the value that was based on. This is called sometimes called causality. The idea is that if we see that y was set to a value and we look up the things that y was computed based on, we're not going to read an older version of those where it doesn't make sense how y was computed. But these are nice restrictions, but they actually aren't enough to do the stuff we want, which is to like conveniently implement locks. So even when we're talking about weird things like that wild note from Alice algorithm. So we're going to have some special instructions that are going to do two different things. So one is that we're going to have special instructions with stronger ordering rules. So x86 has instructions that actually do the atomic load and store we want, but they're not the default. Which have where the instruction won't reorder things. It also has special instructions which restrict reordering around it. So there's instructions called fences where we say, when you see this instruction, don't reorder things from before the instruction to execute after it or vice versa. And that's going to let us do what we want. So you might say, well, this seems like a disaster. And there's another reason why we get into trouble like this. So here, like I had it just with assembly, but this problem is actually worse when you're like writing C. So here's my implementation of the algorithm, the buying milk once algorithm we saw earlier. And so Alice is writing a note, then she's waiting for a note from Bob, and way my compiler compiles this with some optimizations is that it sets the note from Alice. It reads the note from Bob into a register, then it loops on that register EAX over and over again without ever rereading the global variable. So that's not going to work very well. And this is an example of the compiler reordering loads and stores. They just said, well, we need to load that value. We'll just load it once rather than multiple times just before. Because the compiler, the optimizer, unless it's told otherwise, it's going to assume it's writing single-threaded code. So you need to tell it that you're doing something. And there are other cases where this comes up. So here, I decide that instead of having my note from Alice being set to 1, I'm going to set it to 1 while I'm working, and then to 2 at the end. Seems like a harmless change, as long as Bob is checking for the right value. And my compiler says, gosh, well, you're setting it to 2, and that means I don't need to set it to 1, because we're setting it to 2 anyways. So my compiler just omits the setting it to 1. Don't need to do that. Why would we bother? So you might say, well, how do we write any useful code given that this happens, which uses multiple threads? And the answer is that things that we're going to use to cooperate between threads are going to be special for the compiler. So the notable way in which this happens is that the synchronizing functions from pthreads, all the functions you use to like wait for threads, to lock things, prevent reordering. So they're the compiler has been told, hey, when you see a mutex lock or a join, that means there are multiple threads involved. Don't do this tricky stuff where you decide, I don't need to actually write the value of this variable. I need to do it. So if you use the pthreads functions to communicate between your threads, so like pthread join is going to actually assume that the other thread's going to update things and not roll those values earlier. And mutex lock and unlock are going to assume that while, you know, the mutex, while I was waiting for the mutex to acquire its lock, the other thread updated things. So it's going to make the compiler not do this stuff, and it's also going to do the appropriate things to make the processor not reorder loads and stores. So pthreads handles all this nasty problems for you if you use its functions. It's going to add the right instructions to make it work and tell the compiler what's going on. And the way this works internally is that, well, compilers support special features to implement things like this. So I'm going to give you an example of C++'s versions of this. In the 2011 standard, they have this atomic header, which has special low-level things that you would use to implement something like pthreads, which handle the let's make sure the compiler doesn't reorder loads and stores, and let's implement those special instructions so the processor doesn't mess us up. So, for example, here I'm using this special function, atomic thread fence, which says, hey, processor and compiler, don't reorder my loads. Don't load values early. Really, I want you to check note from Bob, even if it was just written. I don't want you to have an old version of it. And also, I want to make sure my note from Alice was already written. I don't want you to decide I can write that later. So that's what this atomic thread fence function does. And when I compile this with GCC, it generates this mfence instruction in x86-64. So we set the note from Alice, so the compiler doesn't move that, wouldn't do it even if I set it to 2, below like before. And in the loop, it reads note from Bob every time. It doesn't use a register because I have this restriction here. And it has this special instruction to tell the processor, hey, I really mean it. Don't do this load at the wrong time. And don't do the prior store to note from Alice at the wrong time. I don't want to have that inconsistency where like they're both zero and it doesn't make any sense. There's also an interface where you have atomic values where you just say, I want to store or load things into the value, which does something similar. And where the compiler will figure out, oh, I need to put this special fence instruction in, and it does it at the appropriate time. And here, figure does it outside the loop because it turns out that this just move from memory to a value will at least do the right thing. It will load it every time, as long as you have this fence to make sure the store happens first. So this is the low-level mechanism. We won't use it, but this is the sort of tools that exist to implement things like locks. But we're going to have something more special than this load and store we'll talk about in a bit. But we have this special synchronization instruction, mfence. So something to note about, like, why don't we do this all the time? So a common complaint when people see this is, you know, why does the compiler not just, you know, generate this all the time if we have a way of doing this? And the answer is that it's really slow. That it's slow because, well, reordering loads and stores made things faster, and it's just a slow instruction, actually. The processor is not deemed fit to make it particularly fast. Apparently it takes like 33 cycles, even ignoring the cost of any loads that might be, you know, we might need to wait for, stores we might need to wait for, or not be able to start earlier. Okay. So any questions about these sort of basic atomic loads and stores and reordering? Okay, so let's talk about, well, we know how we get the processor and the compiler not to reorder things. Now, let's talk about how does multi-core actually work as far as connecting the CPUs and memory. So if we have multiple processors in a common memory, how does that work? And this is going to be important for discussing how do we actually have things synchronized between them. In particular, we're going to want something that's more powerful than an atomic load and store. We have our way of implementing that silly algorithm we saw earlier, where we have these busy loops and separate variables for Alice and Bob, but we want something better. But to know what that better thing might look like, we need to think about, well, what options are available at the hardware level that the hardware could provide us? Doesn't make sense for the hardware to provide us a lock primitive. And to know about that, we need to think about how does the cores communicate with memory? Because that's what they share, is they share a common memory. And we're going to have a very simple model for how that works. We're going to talk about a shared bus. And we're going to say that there's one common communication line that everyone's connected to. All the CPUs and all the memory is connected to this common communication line. And that if there's multiple communicators, we have contention, and there's some hardware mechanism to make sure everyone takes turns. And this is a real way people have set up multi-core systems to talk to memory. And it works. I note that this design, obviously, if we had like 1,000 CPUs, it's a bit of a problem. We have one wire for 1,000 CPUs. It's not going to work out very well. So there are other designs. We're going to gloss over those. We're not going to talk about them. But the same basic principles apply. So we're just going to do this shared bus design, the simplest possible thing, way of connecting CPUs, multiple CPUs and multiple memories together so they can cooperate. And a big issue which comes up with this design is that we want to combine this with caches. That the big reason we wanted to reorder loads and stores is memory is slow. And another way memory is slow is that, well, it's so slow we don't want to go to memory most of the time. We want to go to a cache. And the cache is not going to be over here at the memory, it's going to be at each of the CPUs. Each CPU is going to want to have as close to the computation as possible a copy of the data from memory they're working with. So the big issue we need to deal with is what happens when multiple CPUs want to keep the same data in their cache. When they're accessing the same memory, how do we make that work? In particular, we want that to work in a way where I can have this atomic load and store property. And this was one of the challenges why, we had this reordering, is that to make caches be efficient, we didn't want to have to constantly check who has a copy. So this is an issue known as cache coherency. So let's say we have two CPUs, and both of these CPUs have address A300 cached. So they're both cached. And a question is, well, let's say CPU 1 is writing code, which is going to write to that address. Let's say it's the value of like the variable x, that like from our example of reordering earlier. A question we need to ask is, well, when do the other values change? We have three copies of that value. We have one copy that the CPU has that it's trying to modify. We have the copy the other core has, and we have a copy that memory has. And we can't really change them all in perfect sync. And if we're going to do that, we need to figure out how we make that happen. So this is a problem we're going to need to resolve in order to have loads and stores for shared data work. We need to make some decision about how this happens. And there's a particular style of solutions that are going to be based heavily on this shared bus. That we have this one way to communicate values both to other cores and to memory, and we're going to take advantage of that. And the key concept we're going to use is that, well, let's say CPU2 wasn't here. Then, eventually, CPU1 would write this value not just to its cache, but to memory. And we're going to take advantage of that, how that works. Is that, well, when it does that, CPU2, for free, gets a copy of that write. It can say, oh, I can see on the wire, even though I'm not communicating, that CPU1 is sending a new value for A300 to CPU2, and it's going to do what is known as snoop on that communication. And it's going to say, oh, I know you're using this. I'm going to update my cache appropriately. So the idea here is that everyone looks at what's happening on this shared bus and says, do I care about this? And if so, they're going to actually update their bad cache entries appropriately. And we're going to figure out a way of doing this where we actually keep everything consistent. So to do this, we need to actually keep a little extra information about our cache block. And I'm going to talk about a scheme for keeping everyone in sync, where we keep just extra state for each block, each piece of data we store in the caches. And we're going to replace, if you may remember from the prior class, valid and dirty bits, these are going to replace those. It's going to be the same information encoded in a different way. And we're going to update these based on when values are read, values are written, or when we notice someone else is writing the value or reading the value. And each cache is going to have their own state for each block. So CPU1 and CPU2 might have the same data, but it might have a different state for it, depending on whether they're reading or writing the value recently. And we're going to start with three sets of states: modified, shared, or invalid. So a cache is going to have this modified state for a block when it has an updated value that other caches don't have. It's going to have the shared state when it is reading and has the same value that every other cache has and memory has. And otherwise, it's going to have the invalid state, in which case it shouldn't use that value for anything. So the idea here is that when we're writing, we're going to have this property that the cache is in, hash has a block in the modified state, and no other cache is going to have the block at all. And when we're only reading, we're going to allow multiple caches to have copies of the value, but it's going to be in this shared state where we can't write to it yet, because it's the shared state tells us if it's in the shared state, we are only reading it so far. And otherwise, it's going to be in the invalid state. And we're going to update this based on what we hear going on. So here's our scheme. So let's say I have nothing cached, and I just want to read a value. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to look up the value in my cache. It's not there, so I look up that cache block and I get it's in the invalid state. I don't have a copy of this value at all. And I find out I'm doing a read, so I'm going to read it from memory. And by doing that, I'm going to go to the shared state. I have a copy of the value that's from memory. Okay. And let's say then I'm in the shared state now, and I try to write it. I'm going to say, okay, I look up the value of my cache, it's in the shared state, I'm doing a write, and I want to transition to modified, but I'm going to tell everyone I'm doing that. So to write a value, I'm going to say, I'm writing a value, and I'm going to tell everyone about the write. So this is basically write through, and that means anyone else who hears about this write is going to get rid of their copy of the value. So if I'm in the shared state and I hear about some other processor writing, I'm going to look here and I'm going to say, oh, I need to get rid of my copy. So if we're writing while shared, we have to send the write to others. That's what this table tells us. And we move to the modified state now that we know we've gotten rid of everyone else's copy of the value. And if I hear a write while share, I change to invalid. And that means I know I need to read the value later if I want a copy of it. I don't have the current version anymore because someone else wrote it. And if I have it in the modified state, I can keep writing to it, so I'm still getting the full advantage of my cache. Like, as long as I'm the only one accessing it, I do a little extra checking when I load the value, but after that, I just access it locally in the modified state until I'm done. And note that if I have it modified and someone reads it, well, when I hear the read, I'm going to tell them about it because I'm going to know that they're trying to read it from memory, and I'm going to say, wait a moment, let me write it first. You don't have, if you read it from memory, you won't get the right version. And that's something I can do because we have this shared bus where I know about every time someone else tries to read the value that they don't have in their cache. So questions? So far. So the key idea of this protocol is that only one cache ever has the same data in the modified state. And we ensure it by making sure that when reads and write happen, the other caches get updated to make that true. So as an example, let's say here I have two CPUs with their own caches, and each of their caches has their own states for values. And let's say, to start out, that CPU 1 writes 101 to A300. It's going to send a message to the bus, and it has to do that because it's in the shared state. It can't write in the shared state, even though it has a copy. So it's going to move to the modified state, but to do that, it's going to tell memory, hey, I'm writing this value. And it's in fact going to tell everyone, hey, I'm writing this value. We might update memory at this time, we might not. It doesn't actually matter. But we need to tell everyone this value is being written. And CPU 2 is going to say, oh, you're writing that value, that means my copy is no longer good. And it's going to get rid of its copy by marking it as invalid. So later on, if that tries to read it, it's going to say, nope, not there. Okay. Then later on, let's say we're at 102, we can do that inside the cache. We don't need to communicate anything until we actually get rid of the value. But if there's a read, we have to check for the read and say, oh, I wrote that, modified that value, here's the update. We'll update it if there's a read. But if there's not, we just do nothing. So later on, let's say CPU 2 decides to read this invalid value. It's going to send the read to memory, but we're also going to hear about it. And CPU 1 is going to jump ahead of memory and say, wait a moment. The actual value is 102. Let me just update that for you. And that's how we're going to deal with that read. And based on that value, we're going to end up with CPU 2 getting the value 102. I'm going into this shared state because now everyone is in sync with memory. Okay, so questions on what happened in this example? Yes.
So, does CPU 1 directly communicate with CPU 2, or does it write to memory and then CPU 2 is able to read from memory?
So the question is, did CPU 1 directly send the value to CPU 2? I didn't specify because processors do either, depending on how they're implemented. Yeah?
Is this done with like a separate component, or does like the processor stop everything whenever they hear like
So the question is, where is this implemented? So this is going to be part of the hardware of the cache. We're not going to, generally processors aren't going to have the OS have code that runs for this. This is going to be something done by the hardware. As for stopping everything, if we have one bus, well, if we're using it to send these messages, we can't use it to do reads and writes. And that is a real thing you can notice in performance. Other questions?
Is there a performance? Is it good for performance that CPU 1 never doesn't write to memory until CPU is trying to read it?
The question is it good for performance that CPU 1 doesn't write to memory until CPU tries to read it? So usually yes. So this is optimized for the common case of the caches are helpful, and we are accessing values that are in the cache for a good reason on that processor, so we want it to be local to that processor, and we're not often going to share things, right? And that's the common case for a program. If you think of what values are typically in the cache, it's often going to be things like our stack. For our stack, what we want is exactly that we typically keep things on the processor that's executing that thread with its stack, but we have to deal with the possibility that even though that's the stack, some other processor might read it. So we're optimizing for the case where things stay local to a single processor, and indeed that might make the case where they don't slower sometimes, but that's a design decision that this scheme has made. And you could imagine, and maybe some processors do things, where you might try to handle the cases where you know values are shared differently. And write things proactively to memory and so on. Other questions? Yeah. This question is the shared state, the desired state. So the shared state is the state where if we write, we need to go to another state. So if you're only reading, it's great. If you're writing, well, that's not actually what you want to be happening. Right. Okay. So other questions about this theme? Okay. So this MSI, this modified shared invalid scheme, when we write a value, we invalidate others. You could actually send the value. You don't need to, usually. You can just say, I am writing a value for the purposes of getting them to the invalid state, as long as they're not reading it. And that's a common thing that real processors do, is that they just send the address and to invalidate it for the initial write. And note that we still need to actually write back values. Also note that something which can happen, which I didn't show in the picture, is sometimes we run out of space in our cache. In that case, we still need to write back values. That's something which still happens. I just didn't show it. So this is our states for MSI. So modified, the value might be different than memory. Maybe it's not. And I am the only one who has a copy of it in cache. And we make sure we know if someone else gets a copy of it and move out of the modified state so we don't have inconsistencies. Shared is my value is the same as memory, and invalid is I don't have the value, I'm going to have to ask for it, I'm going to have to send a read message on the bus to get a copy. Okay. So the scheme I've shown you here is something that real processors have used. Often there are extensions used to this scheme. So these usually involve making this list of states longer. So one example of an extension is to have extra states for having an unmodified version of a value, but remembering that you're the only one cache with a copy of it, just to save writing back values that aren't changed. Another extension is to allow values to be sent directly between caches without writing them back to memory first. And another thing is that if you have like 16 cores, maybe you don't want all of them to be on a shared bus, so you'll have a fancier protocol to, a fancier way of tracking states to avoid doing that. So you can only send messages to cores which might have a copy, not all of them all the time. But this is a basic scheme, and it's enough to think about how are we going to actually implement things like locks, starting from here. So any questions about our MSI scheme, or any of the basic idea of these extensions? Okay. So on top of this scheme for having two processors have values in sync, we're going to have some special hardware support to help us implement locks. And the basic form of this is something known as atomic read, modify, write instructions. So this is one instruction that atomically, so all at once, without anything else interrupting it, reads a value, modifies it based on the original value, and writes it back. And if you think about our implementation, this is actually really easy to implement on top of the scheme for keeping caches in sync I showed you earlier, because what we do is we get the value into this modified state and just change it however we like. And we just make sure it doesn't get out of the modified state for this single instruction. So these are what instructions which just do something like an add or some other operation on a value, but just make sure it's in the modified state the whole time. And that's why the hardware can provide this sort of support for us. Now, the question is, what operation, what type of modification are we going to provide as a hardware manufacturer for this operation? And there's tons of choices, and pretty much everyone is made by some processor you can find somewhere. And x86 supports a lot of them. I'm going to talk about probably the simplest x86 atomic operation it supports, and also one that XV6 uses to implement its lock. And this is atomic exchange. So this is the instruction. It takes two registers, one of which is used to access memory, that's ECX here, one of which is a register that's value is used. And we access memory at location of one register and swap it with the value in the other register. So this is our pseudocode. We move the memory value into a temporary and we move the value from the non-memory address register into that memory location and then move the temporary into the non-memory address register. But we do this atomically, meaning that nothing interferes with this, that this is we read the value and write it without any other processor reading or writing the value in between. Okay. So this makes sense? Questions? And so the implementation of this is we get the value into the modified state to do the write, and we just record the value it had before. So it's actually pretty conceptually simple, at least, to implement in hardware. And we're going to use this to build a test and set instruction. This is often the more common atomic operation. So we have an instruction that we're going to write a fixed value and read the old value. So we're going to use this to implement a simple lock. So our write is going to be to mark the lock as taken. And we're going to read, was it already taken? And this implements the essential thing we want from a lock, and sure is a lot easier than that note from Alice, note from Bobsky. So we mark the lock is taken, no matter what, and there's two possibilities. Either it wasn't taken before, no one else wrote that the lock was taken, and then we find out with atomic exchange, oh, it wasn't taken before, we're great. That we got it, we have the lock, we can move on, assuming we're the only one doing, like, buying milk. If we find out it was already taken, if the atomic exchange tells us, yeah, you would just exchange taken with taken, then we say, okay, it's still taken, so that's fine, but it was already taken, so we didn't get it, we need to move on. So we can use this to implement what's known as a spin lock. So here is a 64-bit x86 spin lock with atomic exchange. So we move one into a register, and we atomically exchange that value with the address of the lock, where hopefully this is the memory address. So this is the memory location to exchange with. So we're exchanging one with the memory location, and we test afterwards, was it already one? And if the answer is yes, then we go back to the beginning. And try again. And we keep trying until it's not one. And the idea is while someone else is using the lock, while someone else has it, it's going to stay as one, but when we're done with a lock, we're going to set it to zero. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And this allows someone else who's acquiring the lock to actually get a copy of it, because after we set it to zero, they'll do their atomic exchange, and they'll find out, oh, it was already zero now, so now I got it this time. We also have as some nits that we need to deal with, is there load and store reordering? So for the release, I have a fence here to say, hey, processor, please do all the stores I just did while holding this lock before I release it. Like, don't let someone start going through code after the acquire until that's all done. And it turns out that the lock exchange instruction avoids load and store reordering. This is why I don't have another one of those fence instructions. And I wouldn't expect you to know that. It just happens to work out. Yes?
Is there a reason you don't have to use the atomic exchange for unlock?
It just happens that it works correctly to do it. So we only care that things that happened while the lock was held are visible, and the fence is enough to do that. And we care that the store of zero into the lock happens eventually, and the processor will guarantee that. It's okay if it happens sometime a little later, and by not doing a lock instruction, we're saying that's fine. It's fine if there's other things I do which this happens after, as long as I release the lock soon. So I don't add extra fence instructions. It wouldn't be wrong to do so, but it would be slow. But by not doing that, I'm saying if there's like that, for example, return, like if I have like a, after release, I have like a move into a global variable that might happen before I release the lock. I'm saying if that happens, it's fine. Because there's no way I would notice. So other questions? Yeah. So how does it become unlocked? The code using this is going to do acquire and use shared stuff, like say in our case or a scheduler, like the list of processes. And then it's going to do release. And the idea is that this is for multi-core. So while we're doing this on core number one, core number two is doing the same stuff, same code, but with, you know, use shared stuff in some other way. And so the idea is that this second acquire occurs like in the middle of here, and it's going to wait until the release happens. And sometime after the release, core two is going to do its share stuff where they share data. Yeah.
Can we ever like try to acquire a lock and then if it's taken, move on? In the case like if someone's gonna hold on to a lock for a really long time, you don't.
So do we ever, so a question, acquire a lock and it's taken, move on? There are cases where we might do that. We'll talk about one when we talk about deadlock much later on. And if we wanted that, we could implement a version of acquire which worked that way, where we, instead of looping back to the beginning, we just return, hey, you didn't get it, move on. Okay, other questions? Yeah?
So SpinLock, can you talk about when you want to use SpinLock, or do you always want to use it?
So the question is, can I talk about when we want to use SpinLock? So you, so XV6 uses one, because it's the most basic lock, and that's where they're using it, the simplest one to implement. And when we talk about other types of locks, we'll find out that most of them are implemented with spin locks. So you kind of don't have a choice, you're going to use it somehow when you're implementing locks. But indeed, like we talked about pthread mutex, that's what you'll use, and you won't care how it works, mostly. Okay, so we saw atomic exchange. As I said, there are a variety of atomic operations. And these are often provided as instructions like our lock exchange instruction in x86. So you saw x86 had this exchange. Some processors have a test and set instruction, which is just basically exchange with one and check if it was one, which is what we're emulating with atomic exchange here. And there's more complicated instructions that exist in many processors that are atomic instructions. So one example is compare and swap, which takes an old value, checks if a value in memory is equal to that. If so, sets it to a new value. Otherwise, does nothing and tells you what it did. And this exists on XE6 via the lock comp exchange instruction. And another example is fetch and add, which exists in x86 via lock at x add l, or x add, which reads a value from memory, adds to it, and returns the original value that was read at the same time. These are all atomic operations, meaning that the implementation is that they're held, done with that cache block in the modified state, so no one else sneaks in the middle. That we find out what the value was before we added to it, no matter when other people are modifying it. We find that out exactly then. We don't find out a different version of it for everyone. Or for compare and swap, we change it from the old value to the new value and nothing else. If it's not exactly equal to the old value, we don't change it ever. Even if it was at some point before the old value, it's when we make the change, it happens or doesn't. So, questions on these operations? And yeah, so we have a variety of these. What processors provide depends on what they do, what they want to support. So things like this are easier to implement for the processor, but less flexible. Things like compare and swap are actually, you can do a whole lot of stuff with, including stuff which doesn't look like locks. So one example is, let's say I want to append to assembly linked list. The procedure is I find the end of the list, and I replace a next pointer that's pointing to null with a pointer to my new linked list element. So I can do that, in fact, if I'm really careful, with compare and swap. I find the end of the list, and then I double check that it's really the end with compare and swap by changing it from null to pointing to a new next element. And this code, if I have multiple people trying to append at the same time, and then I can have adding to the list done with this atomic operation without doing anything like locks. So this idea makes sense. So we're just looking for the end of the list. We find the null pointer that's there. But rather than trying to write to it directly, we're worried that someone else might write at the same time. So we use this atomic compare and swap to only write to it if it was null just before we change it. And because we know that that's one at a time, this actually modifies the list in a way which worked correctly if multiple processors are doing it, assuming everyone's only appending and nothing else. So this is something you might see every once in a while, and it shows a general pattern that we've seen every time we see these atomic operations, even for locks, which is we try to do something with the atomic operation, use the atomic operation to tell, did it work? And if it didn't, we try again. So we're seeing that here. We try to append to the list, assuming we append to the right place. We find out, did we? Or did someone else sneak in the middle? And if so, we try again. With our lock, we try to acquire the lock, assuming it's okay. And we find out, no, it wasn't. Someone else had it. And then we try again. And this is the general pattern you'll see with all these operations. And just as a note on this type of code, like I'm showing you this example, this is sometimes a useful thing to do, but it's really tricky to reason about when this is safe. So I don't recommend it for real code, but you'll see sometimes people do it because it's a little bit faster than using a lock. Just a little bit faster. Sometimes. But it's a good example of the general pattern we have for using atomic operations, which is try to do something, detect if that thing you tried failed, and if so, repeat. So with that strategy in mind, given compare and swap, how do you implement fetch and add? Remember, fetch and add was read the old value and change it to a new value atomically. Tell me what the code for this looks like. Anyone with like a, just a sketch? Yeah.
Could you try so you try multiple values of old value until you get like the right one in compare and swap, and always have your new value be like just however much you want to add plus the old value?
Yeah. So we can use compare and swap. So we make our guess as to what the old value is, and then try to swap, use the compare and swap to swap that with the old value plus the amount. And the code looks something like this. We get our guess by reading it non-atomically, which might be wrong, but that's fine. Because we'll try again, and eventually we should read the right value. Okay, so this is our pseudocode solution for how that works. Okay. Questions? And I'm assuming the compiler will generate a real read and not like keep it in a register to make this work. Okay, so with that in mind, let's talk about what XV6 does now that we've talked about atomic operations. So XV6 uses exactly the strategy we saw with the lock exchange. It uses a slightly different way of doing the stuff about synchronization. So it has this special synchronize, which is equivalent to mfence. It doesn't actually generate an mfence instruction because that's not a 32-bit x86 instruction. So it generates a weird lock instruction if you look at the assembly. But this exchange function just wraps the lock exchange thing we saw in assembly before, and this synchronize generates one of those fences to make sure all loads before and stores before happen before we move on. And we have something similar on the release side. We have this sync synchronize to generate that fence that makes sure all the stores actually happen, and then a store into zero into the lock variable. So it's exactly the same design of lock we saw earlier. The assembly is a little bit different. It's exactly, that's how the spin lock works. That combined with disabling interrupts and re-enabling them to handle the single core case to make sure if a timer interrupt happens while we have the lock, well, it doesn't actually happen. We've disabled the interrupt. Okay, so questions on this? Okay. So that's the XV6 spin lock. It's turns into basically the same assembly with just a little different way of dealing with that reordering issue. It also has some extra code to do debugging. So we have this, are we the ones holding this lock? If so, give up, to make sure that you know if you like acquire and acquire while you before you've released. And also we record to implement that, which CPU has the lock right now, just to do that debugging. But that's not part of the lock, it's just to help figure out what happens if you use the lock incorrectly, which is useful for, you know, because a common mistake on the lottery homework is to acquire the scheduler lock multiple times without releasing it. Yeah?
So why is it so bad to lock an already locked lock?
So in the case of this, remember what push CLI does? It increments a counter and disables interrupts if they weren't enabled. So pop CLI will decrement the counter and only enable interrupts again if the counter goes to zero. So if you acquire twice, you'll never re-enable interrupts.
Theoretically though, could we just not do that if we're already holding?
So you're asking, could we make a lock where if we're already holding, instead of having this code be panic, we could just return? Absolutely. And this is sometimes known as a recursive lock, and some locks do that. XV6 has made the choice that probably you made a mistake in your code, and we prefer to detect that rather than making it do something arguably useful. Okay, other questions? Okay, so spin locks are useful, but they're kind of inefficient. There's two problems with spin locks, and these are only problems when we have lots of people trying to use the spin lock at once. So one issue is that they can send lots of messages on that shared bus. They're very noisy. Another issue is that they waste a lot of CPU time that we probably don't want to use just for reading a value that we know is taken for one for the lock is held over and over and over again. If you have anything else to do, we want to do it instead. So let's talk about this first issue. And this is actually particularly bad with the spin locks I showed. Because we get into this scenario where, let's say, we have three cores, all using a locked value. And the value is currently set to locked. CPU1 is the one which has the lock. And now let's say CPU2 tries to acquire it. So it's going to try to swap locked with locked. To do that swap, it's going to say, I want to modify lock, get it into the modified state, read that it's locked, set it back to locked, doing nothing. Okay, great. Now let's say CPU3 does the same thing. So it's gonna say, I want to modify locked. It's gonna tell everyone else to invalidate your copies of locked. I'm changing it. And that's fine. And then CPU2, well, it didn't get the lock last time, so it's gonna try again. So CPU2 is going to say, well, I want to modify lock now. And it's going to invalidate CPU3's copy of it. And we'll just keep doing this over and over again. And this, you know, works, but it's problematic. The big problem is that, well, CPU1 is probably trying to do something with memory, and this is going to slow that down. It's still gonna work. The buses usually are designed to like not make it so that when a CPU never gets to use it, but it's gonna slow things down. So this is not ideal. So a common thing you might see to avoid this that XV6 doesn't do is a pattern known as test and test and set, where we first just read the value and we wait for it to become, or I should be, sorry, it is not equal to 0. And we wait for it to become not taken, and then we actually try to do it. So we avoid sending that I want to modify the value message until we think it's probably going to work. So at least while someone else has the lock, we don't interrupt things. And so that leads to assembly like this. So we do a non-atomic check. Is the lock taken still? Is the lock not taken? And if it is taken, we just keep trying the non-atomic check, which is not going to send that I want to modify the value message. It's going to send a read, which is going to go to the shared state. So while the lock is not ready to be taken, we don't actually invalidate anyone's copy of it. We don't send messages all the time. And then we try to do it. Then we might have some extra I want to modify the lock messages that don't do anything, but we save a lot of extra traffic. But the cost is that, assuming we usually the lock is not taken, then we're doing extra instructions to figure that out. But this is something that many real OSs do, something of this sort. Yeah, so what happens here is they'll go to the shared state, everyone will go to the shared state until the lock is released. So we save messages at the cost of making the case where the lock was already not taken a little slower. So there's like whole lectures worth of ways of variants of this. There's lots of actual ways of designing these low-level spin locks. And I've shown you two of them. There's like many, many others. And these are the sorts of trade-offs we have. We have like, how complicated is it to get a lock? How complicated is it to release a lock? How many messages get sent on these shared buses? So there's lots of design choices. So I'm just letting you know that you might see lots of other designs because of concerns like this. Okay, so there's these other spin lock designs which avoid even more messages at the cost of making, well, now it's more complicated, the case where there's no contention might be slower that you might see in real OSs. Okay, so another thing about cache coherency. So we saw that we have these extra messages for two people modifying the same value. Because we have this notion that only one processor can change a value at a time. Another consequence of that is that these values are cache blocks. And our cache blocks are not what we're accessing in memory. So like I've drawn it out as if our lock was the only thing that was in that part of the cache, but actually it's probably like a 64 byte value, which is the lock and everything around it in memory. And if we think about how this works with our scheme, well, if two processors try to write two values which are close to memory, if they're part of the same cache block, only one can write it at a time. They need to say, hey, I'm writing this block, doesn't matter which part, I'm writing it, and one CPU gets a turn to change its little piece of that value, then the other one needs to get its own turn to do that. So they have to go one at a time, even if they're different parts of the same cache block. And you can see this effect empirically. So here I have code which just adds to a single destination variable. It sums up the values in an array into that variable. And I made sure it compiled to something which accessed that pointer every time of the loop. And here I have a destination array which I use some distance apart. I have one accessing element 0 and writing to that over and over again to compute the sum, another accessing element distance where I vary distance. And when element 0 and element distance are in the same cache block, this is going to be a lot slower. And it's going to be a lot slower because we're going to have that ping-ponging again. that we're going to say, I want to modify this cache block, and I want to modify it, and send the value back and forth, even though we're modifying different parts of that cache block size value. And this is like a performance graph I got from my machine. Starts at zero. This is the number of cycles it takes to finish this with both threads. You can see when things are in the same cache block versus not is a big effect. And this is even though they're different elements of the array, that I never ran this with distance zero. They're always different elements of the array, but because they're close by, we see this performance effect. We get the correct results. That's what cache coherency is doing for us. It's making sure that we never have this case where one thread writing the value overwrites the other one's value. But there's a cost. And this problem is known as false sharing. So it's something to avoid. The solution's pretty simple. It's just make sure the values that two threads are working on aren't close by. And it might even be worth having just dummy padding values to do this. Okay, so questions about this? Okay, so next topic is avoiding waiting CPU time. So we talked about avoiding messages on our shared bus, but problems with that. We have one final thing with locks, which is that our locks so far, we wait on the CPU the whole time we have the lock. That's really slow. If we want to have anything else to do with the CPU, it's really slow of like the other process maybe is doing I/O. And we really like to do something else. And this is what mutexes do. And this is why pthreads mutexes have that name, because they should be a lock, which is a different style, which will wait in a better way. So instead of running an infinite loop, we want to detect, oh, I can give up the CPU, let's run the scheduler, but we have to somehow arrange for when someone unlocks the lock. They're not just going to set a variable to zero. They're going to figure out, oh, you went to sleep for this lock. I need to wake you up and tell the scheduler to run you. So these are going to be locks where we're going to get the scheduler involved, because the lock operation is going to put the current process to sleep, mark it as not runnable, and add it to a list of waiting processes. And the unlock operation is not just going to set a value to say the lock isn't taken, it's going to look at that list and wake up one of those processes so it can run using the lock. And to implement this, we're going to use spin locks. And the basic idea is we have a shared data structure here that we want to control access to, and that's the list here, the list of waiting processes. And we need to make sure when multiple cores access that, that it makes sense, that we don't have any desynchronization of any sort. So we're going to use a spin lock to make sure that when two cores want to add something to the list, that they both agree on what happens. So the lock, we're going to use the spin lock, acquire it, add ourselves to the list, then release it after we go to sleep. And for the unlock, we're going to acquire the spin lock to access the list and know that no one else is changing it, and use that to wake someone else up from the list. So we have the spin lock, but we only use the spin lock when we need to access that list. When we're not accessing the list, we don't use the spin lock, so we aren't waiting for a long time. We're only waiting for these very short operations of remove something from a list, add something to a list. So questions on this idea? And this is what I meant by building more complex locks from spin locks. So this is an example of a way of doing that. So this is what our high level structure for our mutex looks like. We have this guard spin lock, we have a taken flag, and we have a queue of waiting processes. The guard spin lock is just how we make sure that we agree on what the current value of lock taken in the queue is. And the list queue is just the list of not runnable threads, and we'll finish this up next time. There's some trickiness in how do we go to sleep and make sure the spin lock gets released at the right time.